the personal weight of Belisarius, the rank, the spirit, and the temper of Germanus, the emperor's nephew, and the vigor and success of the second administration of the eunuch Solomon, restored the modesty of the camp, and maintained for a while the tranquillity of Africa. But the vices of the Byzantine court were felt in that distant province. The troops complained that they were neither paid nor relieved, and as soon as the public disorders were sufficiently mature, Sturza was again alive, in arms, and at the gates of Carthage. He fell in a single combat, but he smiled in the agonies of death when he was informed that his own javelin had reached the heart of his antagonist. The example of Sturza and the assurance that a fortunate soldier had been the first king encouraged the ambition of Guntharis, and he promised by a private treaty to divide Africa with the Moors if, with their dangerous aid, he should ascend the throne of Carthage. The feeble Ariobindus, unskilled in the affairs of peace and war, was raised by his marriage with the niece of Justinian to the office of exarch. He was suddenly oppressed by a sedition of the guards, and his abject supplications, which provoked the contempt, could not move the pity of the inexorable tyrant. After a reign of 30 days, Guntharis himself was stabbed at a banquet by the hand of Artaban, and it is singular enough that an Armenian prince of the royal family of Arsaces should re-establish at Carthage the authority of the Roman Empire. In the conspiracy which unsheathed the dagger of Brutus against the life of Caesar, every circumstance is curious and important to the eyes of posterity. But the guilt or merit of these loyal or rebellious assassins could interest only the contemporaries of Procopius, who, by their hopes and fears, their friendship or resentment, were personally engaged in the revolutions of Africa. That country was rapidly sinking into the state of barbarism from whence it had been raised by the Phoenician colonies and Roman laws, and every step of intestine discord was marked by some deplorable victory of savage man over civilized society. The Moors, though ignorant of justice, were impatient of oppression. Their vagrant life and boundless wilderness disappointed the arms and eluded the chains of a conqueror, and experience had shown that neither oaths nor obligations could secure the fidelity of their attachment. The victory of Mount Aurus had awed them into momentary submission, but if they respected the character of Solomon, they hated and despised the pride and luxury of his two nephews, Cyrus and Sergius, on whom their uncle had imprudently bestowed the provincial governments of Tripoli and Pentapolis. A Moorish tribe encamped under the walls of Leptis to renew their alliance and receive from the governor the customary gifts. 40 of their deputies were introduced as friends into the city, but on the dark suspicion of a conspiracy they were massacred at the table of Sergius, and the clamor of arms and revenge was re-echoed through the valleys of Mount Atlas, from both the cities to the Atlantic Ocean. A personal injury, the unjust execution or murder of his brother, rendered Antalus the enemy of the Romans. The defeat of the Vandals had formally signalized his valor. The rudiments of justice and prudence were still more conspicuous in a Moor, and while he laid Adrumetum in ashes, he calmly admonished the emperor that the peace of Africa might be secured by the recall of Solomon and his unworthy nephews. The exarch led forth his troops from Carthage, but at the distance of 6 days' journey in the neighborhood of Tibesti, he was astonished by the superior numbers and fierce aspect of the barbarians. He proposed a treaty, solicited a reconciliation, and offered to bind himself by the most solemn oaths. "By what oaths can he bind himself?" interrupted the indignant Moors. "Will he swear by the Gospels, the divine books of the Christians? It was on those books that the faith of his nephew Sergius was pledged to 80 of our innocent and unfortunate brethren. Before we trust them a second time, let us try their efficacy in the chastisement of perjury and the vindication of their own honor." Their honor was vindicated in the field of Tibesti by the death of Solomon and the total loss of his army. The arrival of fresh troops and more skillful commanders soon checked the insolence of the Moors. 17 of their princes were slain in the same battle, and the doubtful and transient submission of their tribes was celebrated with lavish applause by the people of Constantinople. Successive inroads had reduced the province of Africa to one-third of the measure of Italy, yet the Roman emperors continued to reign above a century over Carthage and the fruitful coast of the Mediterranean. But the victories and the losses of Justinian were alike pernicious to mankind, and such was the desolation of Africa that in many parts a stranger might wander whole days without meeting the face either of a friend or an enemy. The nation of the Vandals had disappeared. They once amounted to 160,000 warriors, without including the children, the women, or the slaves. Their numbers were infinitely surpassed by the number of the Moorish families extirpated in a relentless war, and the same destruction was retaliated on the Romans and their allies, who perished by the climate, their mutual quarrels, and the rage of the barbarians. When Procopius first landed, he admired the populousness of the cities and country, strenuously exercised in the labors of commerce and agriculture. In less than 20 years, that busy scene was converted into a silent solitude. The wealthy citizens escaped to Sicily and Constantinople, and the secret historian has confidently affirmed that 5 millions of Africans were consumed by the wars and government of the Emperor Justinian. The jealousy of the Byzantine court had not permitted Belisarius to achieve the conquest of Italy, and his abrupt departure revived the courage of the Goths, who respected his genius, his virtue, and even the laudable motive which had urged the servant of Justinian to deceive and reject them. They had lost their king, an inconsiderable loss, their capital, their treasures, the provinces from Sicily to the Alps, and the military force of 200,000 barbarians, magnificently equipped with horses and arms. Yet all was not lost, as long as Pavia was defended by 1,000 Goths, inspired by a sense of honor, the love of freedom, and the memory of their past greatness. The supreme command was unanimously offered to the brave Urias, and it was in his eyes alone that the disgrace of his uncle Vitiges could appear as a reason of exclusion. His voice inclined the election in favor of Hildebald, whose personal merit was recommended by the vain hope that his kinsman Theudes, the Spanish monarch, would support the common interest of the Gothic nation. The success of his arms in Liguria and Venetia seemed to justify their choice, but he soon declared to the world that he was incapable of forgiving or commanding his benefactor. The consort of Hildebald was deeply wounded by the beauty, the riches, and the pride of the wife of Urias, and the death of that virtuous patriot excited the indignation of a free people. A bold assassin executed their sentence by striking off the head of Hildebald in the midst of a banquet. The Rugians, a foreign tribe, assumed the privilege of election, and Totila, the nephew of the late king, was tempted, by revenge, to deliver himself and the garrison of Trevigo into the hands of the Romans. But the gallant and accomplished youth was easily persuaded to prefer the Gothic throne before the service of Justinian, and as soon as the palace of Pavia had been purified from the Rugian usurper, he reviewed the national force of 5,000 soldiers and generously undertook the restoration of the Kingdom of Italy. The successors of Belisarius, 11 generals of equal rank, neglected to crush the feeble and disunited Goths, till they were roused to action by the progress of Totila and the reproaches of Justinian. The gates of Verona were secretly opened to Artabazus at the head of 100 Persians in the service of the empire. The Goths fled from the city. At the distance of 60 furlongs, the Roman generals halted to regulate the division of the spoil. While they disputed, the enemy discovered the real number of the victors. The Persians were instantly overpowered, and it was by leaping from the wall that Artabazus preserved a life which he lost in a few days by the lance of a barbarian who had defied him to single combat. 20,000 Romans encountered the forces of Totila near Faenza and on the hills of Mugello, on the Florentine territory. The ardour of freedmen who fought to regain their country was opposed to the languid temper of mercenary troops, who were even destitute of the merits of strong and well-disciplined servitude. On the first attack, they abandoned their ensigns, threw down their arms, and dispersed on all sides with an active speed, which abated the loss, whilst it aggravated the shame of their defeat. The king of the Goths, who blushed for the baseness of his enemies, pursued with rapid steps the path of honour and victory. Totila passed the Po, traversed the Apennine, suspended the important conquest of Ravenna, Florence, and Rome, and marched through the heart of Italy to form the siege, or rather, the blockade of Naples. The Roman chiefs, imprisoned in their respective cities and accusing each other of the common disgrace, did not presume to disturb his enterprise. But the emperor, alarmed by the distress and danger of his Italian conquests, dispatched to the relief of Naples a fleet of galleys and a body of Thracian and Armenian soldiers. They landed in Sicily, which yielded its copious stores of provisions, but the delays of the new commander, an unwarlike magistrate, protracted the sufferings of the besieged, and the succours which he dropped with a timid and tardy hand were successively intercepted by the armed vessels stationed by Totila in the Bay of Naples. The principal officer of the Romans was dragged with a rope round his neck to the foot of the wall, from whence, with a trembling voice, he exhorted the citizens to implore, like himself, the mercy of the conqueror. They requested a truce, with a promise of surrendering the city if no effectual relief should appear at the end of 30 days. Instead of 1 month, the audacious barbarian granted them 3, in the just confidence that famine would anticipate the term of their capitulation. After the reduction of Naples and Cumae, the provinces of Lucania, Apulia, and Calabria submitted to the king of the Goths. Totila led his army to the gates of Rome, pitched his camp at Tibur, or Tivoli, within 20 miles of the capital, and calmly exhorted the Senate and people to compare the tyranny of the Greeks with the blessings of the Gothic reign. The rapid success of Totila may be partly ascribed to the revolution which 3 years' experience had produced in the sentiments of the Italians. At the command, or at least in the name, of a Catholic emperor, the Pope, their spiritual father, had been torn from the Roman Church, and either starved or murdered on a desolate island. The virtues of Belisarius were replaced by the various or uniform vices of 11 chiefs at Rome, Ravenna, Florence, Perugia, Spoleto, etc., who abused their authority for the indulgence of lust or avarice. The improvement of the revenue was committed to Alexander, a subtle scribe, long practiced in the fraud and oppression of the Byzantine schools, and whose name of Saliction, the scissors, was drawn from the dexterous artifice with which he reduced the size, without defacing the figure of the gold coin. Instead of expecting the restoration of peace and industry, he imposed a heavy assessment on the fortunes of the Italians. Yet his present or future demands were less odious than a prosecution of arbitrary rigour against the persons and property of all those who, under the Gothic kings, had been concerned in the receipt and expenditure of the public money. The subjects of Justinian, who escaped these partial vexations, were opposed by the irregular maintenance of the soldiers, whom Alexander defrauded and despised. And their hasty sallies in quest of wealth or subsistence provoked the inhabitants of the country to await or implore their deliverance from the virtues of a barbarian. Totila was chaste and temperate, and none were deceived, either friends or enemies, who depended on his faith or his clemency. To the husbandmen of Italy, the Gothic king issued a welcome proclamation enjoining them to pursue their important labours and to rest assured that on the payment of the ordinary taxes they should be defended by his valour and discipline from the injuries of war. The strong towns he successively attacked, and as soon as they had yielded to his arms, he demolished the fortifications to save the people from the calamities of a future siege, to deprive the Romans of the arts of defence, and to decide the tedious quarrel of the two nations by an equal and honourable conflict in the field of battle. The Roman captives and deserters were tempted to enlist in the service of a liberal and courteous adversary. The slaves were attracted by the firm and faithful promise that they should never be delivered to their masters, and from the 1,000 warriors of Pavia, a new people under the same appellation of Goths was insensibly formed in the camp of Totila. He sincerely accomplished the articles of capitulation without seeking or accepting any sinister advantage from ambiguous expressions or unforeseen events. The garrison of Naples had stipulated that they should be transported by sea. The obstinacy of the winds prevented their voyage, but they were generously supplied with horses, provisions, and a safe conduct to the gates of Rome. The wives of the senators who had been surprised in the villas of Campania were restored without a ransom to their husbands. The violation of female chastity was inexorably chastised with death, and in the salutary regulation of the edict of the famished Neapolitans, the conqueror assumed the office of a humane and attentive physician. The virtues of Totila are equally laudable, whether they proceeded from true policy, religious principle, or the instinct of humanity. He often harangued his troops, and it was his constant theme that national vice and ruin are inseparably connected, that victory is the fruit of moral as well as military virtue, and that the prince and even the people are responsible for the crimes which they neglect to punish. The return of Belisarius to save the country which he had subdued was pressed with equal vehemence by his friends and enemies, and the Gothic War was imposed as a trust or an exile on the veteran commander. A hero on the banks of the Black Sea, a slave in the palace of Constantinople, he accepted with reluctance the painful task of supporting his own reputation and retrieving the faults of his successors. The sea was open to the Romans. The ships and soldiers were assembled at Salona, near the palace of Diocletian. He refreshed and reviewed his troops at Pola in Istria, coasted round the head of the Adriatic, entered the port of Ravenna, and dispatched orders rather than supplies to the subordinate cities. His first public oration was addressed to the Goths and Romans in the name of the emperor, who had suspended for a while the conquest of Persia, and listened to the prayers of his Italian subjects. He gently touched on the causes and the authors of the recent disasters, striving to remove the fear of punishment for the past and the hope of impunity for the future, and laboring with more zeal than success to unite all the members of his government in a firm league of affection and obedience. Justinian, his gracious master, was inclined to pardon and reward, and it was their interest as well as duty to reclaim their deluded brethren who had been seduced by the arts of the usurper. Not a man was tempted to desert the standard of the Gothic king. Belisarius soon discovered that he was sent to remain the idle and impotent spectator of the glory of a young barbarian, and his own epistle exhibits a genuine and lively picture of the distress of a noble mind. Most excellent prince, we are arrived in Italy, destitute of all the necessary implements of war, men, horses, arms, and money. In our late circuit through the villages of Thrace and Illyricum, we have collected with extreme difficulty about 4,000 recruits, naked and unskilled in the use of weapons and the exercises of the camp. The soldiers already stationed in the province are discontented, fearful, and dismayed. At the sound of an enemy, they dismiss their horses and cast their arms on the ground. No taxes can be raised, since Italy is in the hands of the barbarians. The failure of payment has deprived us of the right of command, or even of admonition. Be assured, dread sir, that the greater part of your troops have already deserted to the Goths. If the war could be achieved by the presence of Belisarius alone, your wishes are satisfied. Belisarius is in the midst of Italy. But if you desire to conquer, far other preparations are requisite. Without a military force, the title of general is an empty name. It would be expedient to restore to my service my own veteran and domestic guards. Before I can take the field, I must receive an adequate supply of light and heavy armed troops, and it is only with ready money that you can procure the indispensable aid of a powerful body of the cavalry of the Huns." An officer in whom Belisarius confided was sent from Ravenna to hasten and conduct the succors. But the message was neglected, and the messenger was detained at Constantinople by an advantageous marriage. After his patience had been exhausted by delay and disappointment, the Roman general repassed the Adriatic and expected at Dyrrhachium the arrival of the troops which were slowly assembled among the subjects and allies of the empire. His powers were still inadequate to the deliverance of Rome, which was closely besieged by the Gothic king. The Appian Way, a march of 40 days, was covered by the barbarians, and as the prudence of Belisarius declined the battle, he preferred the safe and speedy navigation of 5 days from the coast of Epirus to the mouth of the Tiber. After reducing, by force or treaty, the towns of inferior note in the midland provinces of Italy, Totila proceeded not to assault, but to encompass and starve the ancient capital. Rome was afflicted by the avarice and guarded by the valor of Bessus, a veteran chief of Gothic extraction, who filled, with a garrison of 3,000 soldiers, the spacious circle of her venerable walls. From the distress of the people he extracted a profitable trade, and secretly rejoiced in the continuance of the siege. It was for his use that the granaries had been replenished. The charity of Pope Vigilius had purchased and embarked an ample supply of Sicilian corn. But the vessels which escaped the barbarians were seized by a rapacious governor, who imparted a scanty sustenance to the soldiers, and sold the remainder to the wealthy Romans. The medimnus, or fifth part of the quarter of wheat, was exchanged for 7 pieces of gold. 50 pieces were given for an ox, a rare and accidental prize. The progress of famine enhanced this exorbitant value, and the mercenaries were tempted to deprive themselves of the allowance which was scarcely sufficient for the support of life. A tasteless and unwholesome mixture, in which the bran thrice exceeded the quantity of flour, appeased the hunger of the poor. They were gradually reduced to feed on dead horses, dogs, cats, and mice, and eagerly to snatch the grass and even the nettles which grew among the ruins of the city. A crowd of spectres, pale and emaciated, their bodies oppressed with disease and their minds with despair, surrounded the palace of the governor, urged with unavailing truth that it was the duty of a master to maintain his slaves, and humbly requested that he would provide for their subsistence to permit their flight, or command their immediate execution. Bessus replied with unfeeling tranquillity that it was impossible to feed, unsafe to dismiss, and unlawful to kill the subjects of the emperor. Yet the example of a private citizen might have shown his countrymen that a tyrant cannot withhold the privilege of death. Pierced by the cries of 5 children who vainly called on their father for bread, he ordered them to follow his steps, advanced with calm and silent despair to one of the bridges of the Tiber, and covering his face, threw himself headlong into the stream, in the presence of his family and the Roman people. To the rich and pusillanimous, Bessus sold the permission of departure, but the greatest part of the fugitives expired on the public highways or were intercepted by the flying parties of barbarians. In the meanwhile, the artful governor soothed the discontent and revived the hopes of the Romans by the vague reports of the fleets and armies which were hastening to their relief from the extremities of the east. They derived more rational comfort from the assurance that Belisarius had landed at the port, and without numbering his forces, they firmly relied on the humanity, the courage, and the skill of their great deliverer. Part 2. The foresight of Totila had raised obstacles worthy of such an antagonist. 90 furlongs below the city, in the narrowest part of the river, he joined the two banks by strong and solid timbers in the form of a bridge, on which he erected 2 lofty towers, manned by the bravest of his Goths, and profusely stored with missile weapons and engines of offence. The approach of the bridge and towers was covered by a strong and massy chain of iron, and the chain, at either end, on the opposite sides of the Tiber, was defended by a numerous and chosen detachment of archers. But the enterprise of forcing these barriers and relieving the capital displays a shining example of the boldness and conduct of Belisarius. His cavalry advanced from the port along the public road to awe the motions and distract the attention of the enemy. His infantry and provisions were distributed in 200 large boats, and each boat was shielded by a high rampart of thick planks, pierced with many small holes for the discharge of missile weapons. In the front, 2 large vessels were linked together to sustain a floating castle, which commanded the towers of the bridge and contained a magazine of fire, sulphur, and bitumen. The whole fleet, which the general led in person, was laboriously moved against the current of the river. The chain yielded to their weight, and the enemies who guarded the banks were either slain or scattered. As soon as they touched the principal barrier, the fireship was instantly grappled to the bridge. One of the towers, with 200 Goths, was consumed by the flames. The assailants shouted victory, and Rome was saved, if the wisdom of Belisarius had not been defeated by the misconduct of his officers. He had previously sent orders to Bessus to second the operations by a timely sally from the town, and he had fixed his lieutenant, Isaac, by peremptory command to the station of the port. But avarice rendered Bessus immovable, while the youthful ardor of Isaac delivered him into the hands of a superior enemy. The exaggerated rumor of his defeat was hastily carried to the ears of Belisarius. He paused, betrayed in that single moment of his life some emotions of surprise and perplexity, and reluctantly sounded a retreat to save his wife, Antonina, his treasures, and the only harbor which he possessed on the Tuscan coast. The vexation of his mind produced an ardent and almost mortal fever, and Rome was left without protection to the mercy or indignation of Totila. The continuance of hostilities had embittered the national hatred. The Arian clergy was ignominiously driven from Rome. Pelagius, the archdeacon, returned without success from an embassy to the Gothic camp, and a Sicilian bishop, the envoy or nuncio of the Pope, was deprived of both his hands for daring to utter falsehoods in the service of the church and state. Famine had relaxed the strength and discipline of the garrison of Rome. They could derive no effectual service from a dying people, and the inhuman avarice of the merchant at length absorbed the vigilance of the governor. 4 Isaurian sentinels, while their companions slept and their officers were absent, descended by a rope from the wall and secretly proposed to the Gothic king to introduce his troops into the city. The offer was entertained with coldness and suspicion. They returned in safety. They twice repeated their visit. The place was twice examined. The conspiracy was known and disregarded. And no sooner had Totila consented to the attempt than they unbarred the Asinarian gate and gave admittance to the Goths. Till the dawn of day they halted in order of battle, apprehensive of treachery or ambush. But the troops of Bessus, with their leader, had already escaped, and when the king was pressed to disturb their retreat, he prudently replied that no sight could be more grateful than that of a flying enemy. The patricians, who were still possessed of horses, Decius, Basilius, etc., accompanied the governor. Their brethren, among whom Olybrius, Orestes, and Maximus are named by the historian, took refuge in the church of St. Peter. But the assertion that only 500 persons remained in the capital inspires some doubt of the fidelity either of his narrative or of his text. As soon as daylight had displayed the entire victory of the Goths, their monarch devoutly visited the tomb of the Prince of the Apostles. But while he prayed at the altar, 25 soldiers and 60 citizens were put to the sword in the vestibule of the temple. The archdeacon Pelagius stood before him with the Gospels in his hand. O Lord, be merciful to your servant. Pelagius, said Totila with an insulting smile, your pride now condescends to become a suppliant. I am a suppliant, replied the prudent archdeacon. God has now made us your subjects, and as your subjects, we are entitled to your clemency. At his humble prayer, the lives of the Romans were spared, and the chastity of the maids and matrons was preserved inviolate from the passions of the hungry soldiers. But they were rewarded by the freedom of pillage, after the most precious spoils had been reserved for the royal treasury. The houses of the senators were plentifully stored with gold and silver, and the avarice of Bessus had laboured with so much guilt and shame for the benefit of the conqueror. In this revolution, the sons and daughters of Roman consuls lasted the misery which they had spurned or relieved, wandered in tattered garments through the streets of the city, and begged their bread, perhaps without success, before the gates of their hereditary mansions. The riches of Rusticiana, the daughter of Symmachus and widow of Boethius, had been generously devoted to alleviate the calamities of famine. But the barbarians were exasperated by the report that she had prompted the people to overthrow the statues of the great Theodoric, and the life of that venerable matron would have been sacrificed to his memory if Totila had not respected her birth, her virtues, and even the pious motive of her revenge. The next day he pronounced two orations to congratulate and admonish his victorious gods, and to reproach the Senate as the vilest of slaves with their perjury, folly, and ingratitude, sternly declaring that their estates and honours were justly forfeited to the companions of his arms. Yet he consented to forgive their revolt, and the senators repaid his clemency by dispatching circular letters to their tenants and vassals in the provinces of Italy, strictly to enjoin them to desert the standard of the Greeks, to cultivate their lands in peace, and to learn from their masters the duty of obedience to a Gothic sovereign. Against the city which had so long delayed the course of his victories, he appeared inexorable. One-third of the walls in different parts were demolished by his command. Fire and engines prepared to consume or subvert the most stately works of antiquity. And the world was astonished by the fatal decree that Rome should be changed into a pasture for cattle. The firm and temperate remonstrance of Belisarius suspended the execution. He warned the barbarian not to sully his fame by the destruction of those monuments which were the glory of the dead and the delight of the living. And Totila was persuaded by the advice of an enemy to preserve Rome as the ornament of his kingdom, or the fairest pledge of peace and reconciliation. When he had signified to the ambassadors of Belisarius his intention of sparing the city, he stationed an army at the distance of 120 furlongs to observe the motions of the Roman general. With the remainder of his forces he marched into Lucania and Apulia, and occupied on the summit of Mount Garganus one of the camps of Hannibal. The senators were dragged in his train, and afterwards confined in the fortresses of Campania. The citizens, with their wives and children, were dispersed in exile, and during 40 days Rome was abandoned to desolate and dreary solitude. The loss of Rome was speedily retrieved by an action to which, according to the event, the public opinion would apply the names of rashness or heroism. After the departure of Totila, the Roman general sallied from the port at the head of 1,000 horse, cut in pieces the enemy who opposed his progress, and visited with pity and reverence the vacant space of the eternal city. Resolved to maintain a station so conspicuous in the eyes of mankind, he summoned the greatest part of his troops to the standard which he erected on the capital. The old inhabitants were recalled by the love of their country and the hopes of food, and the keys of Rome were sent a second time to the Emperor Justinian. The walls, as far as they had been demolished by the Goths, were repaired with rude and dissimilar materials. The ditch was restored. Iron spikes were profusely scattered in the highways to annoy the feet of the horses, and as new gates could not certainly be procured, the entrance was guarded by a Spartan rampart of his bravest soldiers. At the expiration of 25 days, Totila returned by hasty marches from Apulia to avenge the injury and disgrace. Belisarius expected his approach. The Goths were thrice repulsed in 3 general assaults. They lost the flower of their troops. The royal standard had almost fallen into the hands of the enemy, and the fame of Totila sunk as it had risen with the fortune of his arms. Whatever skill and courage could achieve had been performed by the Roman general. It remained only that Justinian should terminate by a strong and seasonable effort the war which he had ambitiously undertaken. The indolence, perhaps the impotence, of a prince who despised his enemies and envied his servants, protracted the calamities of Italy. After a long silence, Belisarius was commanded to leave a sufficient garrison at Rome and to transport himself into the province of Lucania, whose inhabitants, inflamed by Catholic zeal, had cast away the yoke of their Arian conquerors. In this ignoble warfare, the hero, invincible against the power of the barbarians, was basely vanquished by the delay, the disobedience, and the cowardice of his own officers. He reposed in his winter quarters of Crotona, in the full assurance that the 2 passes of the Lucanian hills were guarded by his cavalry. They were betrayed by treachery or weakness, and the rapid march of the Goths scarcely allowed time for the escape of Belisarius to the coast of Sicily. At length a fleet and army were assembled for the relief of Ruscianum, or Rossano, a fortress 60 furlongs from the ruins of Sybaris, where the nobles of Lucania had taken refuge. In the first attempt, the Roman forces were dissipated by a storm. In the second, they approached the shore, but they saw the hills covered with archers, the landing place defended by a line of spears, and the king of the Goths impatient for battle. The conqueror of Italy retired with a sigh, and continued to languish, inglorious and inactive, till Antonina, who had been sent to Constantinople to solicit succors, obtained, after the death of the empress, the permission of his return. The 5 last campaigns of Belisarius might abate the envy of his competitors, whose eyes had been dazzled and wounded by the blaze of his former glory. Instead of delivering Italy from the Goths, he had wandered like a fugitive along the coast without daring to march into the country or to accept the bold and repeated challenge of Totila. Yet in the judgment of the few who could discriminate counsels from events and compare the instruments with the execution, he appeared a more consummate master of the art of war than in the season of his prosperity, when he presented 2 captive kings before the throne of Justinian. The valor of Belisarius was not chilled by age. His prudence was matured by experience. But the moral virtues of humanity and justice seem to have yielded to the hard necessity of the times. The parsimony or poverty of the emperor compelled him to deviate from the rule of conduct which had deserved the love and confidence of the Italians. The war was maintained by the oppression of Ravenna, Sicily, and all the faithful subjects of the empire, and the rigorous prosecution of Herodian provoked that injured or guilty officer to deliver Spoleto into the hands of the enemy. The avarice of Antonina, which had been sometimes diverted by love, now reigned without a rival in her breast. Belisarius himself had always understood that riches in a corrupt age are the support and ornament of personal merit, and it cannot be presumed that he should stain his honour for the public service without applying a part of the spoil to his private emolument. The hero had escaped the sword of the barbarians, but the dagger of conspiracy awaited his return. In the midst of wealth and honours, Ottoban, who had chastised the African tyrant, complained of the ingratitude of courts. He aspired to Praejecta, the emperor's niece, who wished to reward her deliverer, but the impediment of his previous marriage was asserted by the piety of Theodora. The pride of royal descent was irritated by flattery, and the service in which he gloried had proved him capable of bold and sanguinary deeds. The death of Justinian was resolved, but the conspirators delayed the execution till they could surprise Belisarius disarmed and naked in the palace of Constantinople. Not a hope could be entertained of shaking his long-tried fidelity, and they justly dreaded the revenge, or rather the justice, of the veteran general, who might speedily assemble an army in Thrace to punish the assassins, and perhaps to enjoy the fruits of their crime. Delay afforded time for rash communications and honest confessions. Artaban and his accomplices were condemned by the Senate, but the extreme clemency of Justinian detained them in the gentle confinement of the palace till he pardoned their flagitious attempt against his throne and life. If the emperor forgave his enemies, he must cordially embrace a friend whose victories were alone remembered, and who was endeared to his prince by the recent circumstances of their common danger. Belisarius reposed from his toils in the high station of general of the East and count of the domestics, and the elder consuls and patricians respectfully yielded the precedency of rank to the peerless merit of the first of the Romans. The first of the Romans still submitted to be the slave of his wife, but the servitude of habit and affection became less disgraceful when the death of Theodora had removed the baser influence of fear. Janina, their daughter and the sole heiress of their fortunes, was betrothed to Anastasius, the grandson, or rather the nephew, of the empress, whose kind interposition forwarded the consummation of their youthful loves. But the power of Theodora expired. The parents of Janina returned, and her honor, perhaps her happiness, were sacrificed to the revenge of an unfeeling mother who dissolved the imperfect nuptials before they had been ratified by the ceremonies of the church. Before the departure of Belisarius, Perusia was besieged, and few cities were impregnable to the Gothic arms. Ravenna, Ancona, and Crotona still resisted the barbarians, and when Totila asked in marriage one of the daughters of France, he was stung by the just reproach that the king of Italy was unworthy of his title till it was acknowledged by the Roman people. 3,000 of the bravest soldiers had been left to defend the capital. On the suspicion of a monopoly, they massacred the governor and announced to Justinian, by deputation of the clergy, that unless their offense was pardoned and their arrears were satisfied, they should instantly accept the tempting offers of Totila. But the officer who succeeded to the command, his name was Diogenes, deserved their esteem and confidence, and the Goths, instead of finding an easy conquest, encountered a vigorous resistance from the soldiers and people who patiently endured the loss of the port and of all maritime supplies. The siege of Rome would perhaps have been raised if the liberality of Totila to the Isaurians had not encouraged some of their venal countrymen to copy the example of treason. In a dark night, while the Gothic trumpets sounded on another side, they silently opened the gate of St. Paul. The barbarians rushed into the city, and the flying garrison was intercepted before they could reach the harbor of Centumcellae. A soldier trained in the school of Belisarius, Paul of Cilicia, retired with 400 men to the mole of Hadrian. They repelled the Goths, but they felt the approach of famine, and their aversion to the taste of horse flesh confirmed their resolution to risk the event of a desperate and decisive sally. But their spirit insensibly stooped to the offers of capitulation. They retrieved their arrears of pay and preserved their arms and horses by enlisting in the service of Totila. Their chiefs, who pleaded a laudable attachment to their wives and children in the East, were dismissed with honor, and above 400 enemies who had taken refuge in the sanctuaries were saved by the clemency of the victor. He no longer entertained a wish of destroying the edifices of Rome, which he now respected as the seat of the Gothic kingdom. The Senate and people were restored to their country. The means of subsistence were liberally provided, and Totila, in the robe of peace, exhibited the equestrian games of the circus. Whilst he amused the eyes of the multitude, 400 vessels were prepared for the embarkation of his troops. The cities of Rhegium and Tarentum were reduced. He passed into Sicily, the object of his implacable resentment, and the island was stripped of its gold and silver, of the fruits of the earth, and of an infinite number of horses, sheep, and oxen. Sardinia and Corsica obeyed the fortune of Italy, and the seacoast of Greece was visited by a fleet of 300 galleys. The Goths were landed in Corcyra and the ancient continent of Epirus. They advanced as far as Nicopolis, the trophy of Augustus, and Dodona, once famous by the oracle of Jove. In every step of his victories, the wise barbarian repeated to Justinian the desire of peace, applauded the concord of their predecessors, and offered to employ the Gothic arms in the service of the empire. Justinian was deaf to the voice of peace, but he neglected the prosecution of war, and the indolence of his temper disappointed in some degree the obstinacy of his passions. From this salutary slumber the emperor was awakened by the Pope Vigilius and the patrician Cethegus, who appeared before his throne and adjured him, in the name of God and the people, to resume the conquest and deliverance of Italy. Then the choice of the generals, caprice as well as judgment, was shown. A fleet and army sailed for the relief of Sicily under the conduct of Liberius, but his youth and want of experience were afterwards discovered, and before he touched the shores of the island, he was overtaken by his successor. In the place of Liberius, the conspirator Artaban was raised from a prison to military honors, in the pious presumption that gratitude would animate his valor and fortify his allegiance. Belisarius reposed in the shade of his laurels, but the command of the principal army was reserved for Germanus, the emperor's nephew, whose rank and merit had been long depressed by the jealousy of the court. Theodora had injured him in the rights of a private citizen, the marriage of his children, and the testament of his brother. And although his conduct was pure and blameless, Justinian was displeased that he should be thought worthy of the confidence of the malcontents. The life of Germanus was a lesson of implicit obedience. He nobly refused to prostitute his name and character in the factions of the circus. The gravity of his manners was tempered by innocent cheerfulness, and his riches were lent, without interest, to indigent or deserving friends. His valor had formerly triumphed over the Sclavonians of the Danube and the rebels of Africa. The first report of his promotion revived the hopes of the Italians, and he was privately assured that a crowd of Roman deserters would abandon, on his approach, the standard of Totila. His second marriage with Malasuntha, the granddaughter of Theodoric, endeared Germanus to the Goths themselves, and they marched with reluctance against the father of a royal infant, the last offspring of the line of Amale. A splendid allowance was assigned by the emperor. The general contributed his private fortune. His two sons were popular and active, and he surpassed in the promptitude and success of his levies the expectation of mankind. He was permitted to select some squadrons of Thracian cavalry. The veterans, as well as the youth of Constantinople and Europe, engaged their voluntary service, and as far as the heart of Germany, his fame and liberality attracted the aid of the barbarians. The Romans advanced to Sardica. An army of Sclavonians fled before their march. But within 2 days of their final departure, the designs of Germanus were terminated by his malady and death. Yet the impulse which he had given to the Italian war still continued to act with energy and effect. The maritime towns of Ancona, Crotona, Cetumcelli resisted the assaults of Totila. Sicily was reduced by the zeal of Artaban, and the Gothic navy was defeated near the coast of the Adriatic. The two fleets were almost equal, 47 to 50 galleys. The victory was decided by the knowledge and dexterity of the Greeks, but the ships were so closely grappled that only 12 of the Goths escaped from this unfortunate conflict. They affected to depreciate an element in which they were unskilled, but their own experience confirmed the truth of a maxim that the master of the sea will always acquire the dominion of the land. After the loss of Germanus, the nations were provoked to smile by the strange intelligence that the command of the Roman armies was given to a eunuch. But the eunuch Narses is ranked among the few who have rescued that unhappy name from the contempt and hatred of mankind. A feeble, diminutive body concealed the soul of a statesman and a warrior. His youth had been employed in the management of the loom and distaff, in the cares of the household, and the service of female luxury. But while his hands were busy, he secretly exercised the faculties of a vigorous and discerning mind. A stranger to the schools and the camp, he studied in the palace to dissemble, to flatter, and to persuade. And as soon as he approached the person of the emperor, Justinian listened with surprise and pleasure to the manly counsels of his chamberlain and private treasurer. The talents of Narses were tried and improved in frequent embassies. He led an army into Italy, acquired a practical knowledge of the war and the country, and presumed to strive with the genius of Belisarius. 12 years after his return, the eunuch was chosen to achieve the conquest which had been left imperfect by the first of the Roman generals. Instead of being dazzled by vanity or emulation, he seriously declared that unless he were armed with an adequate force, he would never consent to risk his own glory and that of his sovereign. Justinian granted to the favorite what he might have denied to the hero. The Gothic War was rekindled from its ashes, and the preparations were not unworthy of the ancient majesty of the empire. The key of the public treasure was put into his hand to collect magazines, to levy soldiers, to purchase arms and horses, to discharge the arrears of pay, and to tempt the fidelity of the fugitives and deserters. The troops of Germanus were still in arms. They halted at Salona in the expectation of a new leader, and legions of subjects and allies were created by the well-known liberality of the eunuch Narses. The king of the Lombards satisfied or surpassed the obligations of a treaty by lending 2,200 of his bravest warriors, who were followed by 3,000 of their martial attendants. 300 Heruli fought on horseback under Philemuth, their native chief, and the noble Aratus, who adopted the manners and discipline of Rome, conducted a band of veterans of the same nation. Dagisthius was released from prison to command the Huns, and Cobod, the grandson and nephew of the great king, was conspicuous by the regal tiara at the head of his faithful Persians, who had devoted themselves to the fortunes of their prince. Absolute in the exercise of his authority, more absolute in the affection of his troops, Narses led a numerous and gallant army from Philippopolis to Salona, from whence he coasted the eastern side of the Adriatic as far as the confines of Italy. His progress was checked. The East could not supply vessels capable of transporting such multitudes of men and horses. The Franks, who in the general confusion had usurped the greater part of the Venetian province, refused a free passage to the friends of the Lombards. The station of Verona was occupied by Teias, with the flower of the Gothic forces, and that skillful commander had overspread the adjacent country with the fall of woods and the inundation of waters. In this perplexity, an officer of experience proposed a measure, secure by the appearance of rashness, that the Roman army should cautiously advance along the seashore, while the fleet preceded their march, and successively cast a bridge of boats over the mouths of the rivers, the Timavus, the Brenta, the Adige, and the Po, that fall into the Adriatic to the north of Ravenna. 9 days he reposed in the city, collected the fragments of the Italian army, and marching towards Rimini to meet the defense of an insulting enemy. Part 3. The prudence of Narses impelled him to speedy and decisive action. His powers were the last effort of the state. The cost of each day accumulated the enormous account, and the nations, untrained to discipline or fatigue, might be rashly provoked to turn their arms against each other, or against their benefactor. The same considerations might have tempered the ardor of Totila, but he was conscious that the clergy and people of Italy aspired to a second revolution. He felt or suspected the rapid progress of treason, and he resolved to risk the Gothic kingdom on the chance of a day in which the valiant would be animated by instant danger and the disaffected might be awed by mutual ignorance. In his march from Ravenna, the Roman general chastised the garrison of Rimini, traversed in a direct line the hills of Urbino, and re-entered the Flaminian Way, 9 miles beyond the perforated rock, an obstacle of art and nature which might have stopped or retarded his progress. The Goths were assembled in the neighborhood of Rome. They advanced without delay to seek a superior enemy, and the two armies approached each other at the distance of 100 furlongs between Tagina and the sepulchres of the Gauls. The haughty message of Narses was an offer not of peace, but of pardon. The answer of the Gothic king declared his resolution to die or conquer. "What day," said the messenger, "will you fix for the combat?" "The 8th day, replied Totila. But early the next morning he attempted to surprise a foe suspicious of deceit and prepare for battle. 10,000 Heruli and Lombards of approved valor and doubtful faith were placed in the center. Each of the wings was composed of 8,000 Romans. The right was guarded by the cavalry of the Huns. The left was covered by 1,500 chosen horse, destined, according to the emergencies of action, to sustain the retreat of their friends or to encompass the flank of the enemy. From his proper station at the head of the right wing, the eunuch rode along the line, expressing by his voice and countenance the assurance of victory, exciting the soldiers of the emperor to punish the guilt and madness of a band of robbers, and exposing to their view gold chains, collars, and bracelets, the rewards of military virtue. From the event of a single combat, they drew an omen of success, and they beheld with pleasure the courage of 50 archers who maintained a small eminence against 3 successive attacks of the Gothic cavalry. At the distance of only 2 bowshots, the armies spent the morning in dreadful suspense, and the Romans tasted some necessary food without unloosening the cuirass from their breast or the bridle from their horses. Narses awaited the charge, and it was delayed by Totila till he had received his last succors of 2,000 Goths. While he consumed the hours in fruitless treaty, the king exhibited in a narrow space the strength and agility of a warrior. His armor was enchased with gold. His purple banner floated with the wind. He cast his lance into the air, caught it with the right hand, shifted it to the left, threw himself backwards, recovered his seat, and managed a fiery steed in all the paces and evolutions of the equestrian school. As soon as the succors had arrived, he retired to his tent, assumed the dress and arms of a private soldier, and gave the signal of a battle. The first line of cavalry advanced with more courage than discretion, and left behind them the infantry of the second line. They were soon engaged between the horns of a crescent, into which the adverse wings had been insensibly curved, and were saluted from either side by the volleys of 4,000 archers. Their ardor and even their distress drove them forwards to a close and unequal conflict in which they could only use their lances against an enemy equally skilled in all the instruments of war. A generous emulation inspired the Romans and their barbarian allies, and Narses, who calmly viewed and directed their efforts, doubted to whom he should adjudge the prize of superior bravery. The Gothic cavalry was astonished and disordered, pressed and broken, and the line of infantry, instead of presenting their spears or opening their intervals, were trampled under the feet of the flying horse. 6,000 of the Goths were slaughtered without mercy in the field of Tagina. Their prince, with 5 attendants, was overtaken by Osbad of the race of the Gepidi. "Spare the king of Italy," cried a loyal voice, and Osbad struck his lance through the body of Totila. The blow was instantly revenged by the faithful Goths. They transported their dying monarch 7 miles beyond the scene of his disgrace, and his last moments were not embittered by the presence of an enemy. Compassion afforded him the shelter of an obscure tomb, but the Romans were not satisfied of their victory till they beheld the corpse of the Gothic king. His hat, enriched with gems, and his bloody robe were presented to Justinian by the messengers of triumph. As soon as Narses had paid his devotions to the author of victory and the Blessed Virgin, his peculiar patroness, he praised, rewarded, and dismissed the Lombards. The villages had been reduced to ashes by these valiant savages. They ravished matrons and virgins on the altar. Their retreat was diligently watched by a strong detachment of regular forces who prevented a repetition of the like disorders. The victorious eunuch pursued his march through Tuscany, accepted the submission of the Goths, heard the acclamations and often the complaints of the Italians, and encompassed the walls of Rome with the remainder of his formidable host. Round the wide circumference, Narses assigned to himself and to each of his lieutenants a real or a feigned attack, while he silently marked the place of easy and unguarded entrance. Neither the fortifications of Hadrian's Mole nor of the port could long delay the progress of the conqueror, and Justinian once more received the keys of Rome, which, under his reign, had been 5 times taken and recovered. But the deliverance of Rome was the last calamity of the Roman people. The barbarian allies of Narses too frequently confounded the privileges of peace and war. The despair of the flying Goths found some consolation in sanguinary revenge, and 300 youths of the noblest families who had been sent as hostages beyond the Po were inhumanly slain by the successor of Totila. The fate of the Senate suggests an awful lesson of the vicissitude of human affairs. Of the senators whom Totila had banished from their country, some were rescued by an officer of Belisarius and transported from Campania to Sicily, while others were too guilty to confide in the clemency of Justinian, or too poor to provide horses for their escape to the seashore. Their brethren languished 5 years in a state of indigence and exile. The victory of Narses revived their hopes, but their premature return to the metropolis was prevented by the furious Goths, and all the fortresses of Campania were stained with patrician blood. After a period of 13 centuries, the institution of Romulus expired. And if the nobles of Rome still assumed the title of senators, few subsequent traces can be discovered of a public council or constitutional order. Ascend 600 years and contemplate the kings of the earth soliciting an audience as the slaves or freedmen of the Roman Senate. The Gothic War was yet alive. The bravest of the nation retired beyond the Po, and Titus was unanimously chosen to succeed and revenge their departed hero. The new king immediately sent ambassadors to implore, or rather to purchase, the aid of the Franks, and nobly lavished for the public safety the riches which had been deposited in the palace of Pavia. The residue of the royal treasure was guarded by his brother Alagern at Cumae in Campania, but the strong castle which Totila had fortified was closely besieged by the arms of Narses. From the Alps to the foot of Mount Vesuvius, the Gothic king, by rapid and secret marches, advanced to the relief of his brother, eluded the vigilance of the Roman chiefs, and pitched his camp on the banks of the Sarnus, or Draco, which flows from Nuceria into the Bay of Naples. The river separated the two armies. 60 days were consumed in distant and fruitless combats, and Titus maintained this important post till he was deserted by his fleet and the hope of subsistence. With reluctant steps he ascended the Lactarian Mount, where the physicians of Rome, since the time of Galen, had sent their patients for the benefit of the air and the milk. But the Goth soon embraced a more generous resolution, to descend the hill, to dismiss their horses, and to die in arms and in the possession of freedom. The king marched at their head, bearing in his right hand a lance and an ample buckler in his left. With the one he struck dead the foremost of the assailants. With the other he received the weapons which every hand was ambitious to aim against his life. After a combat of many hours, his left arm was fatigued by the weight of 12 javelins which hung from his shield. Without moving from his ground or suspending his blows, the hero called aloud on his attendants for a fresh buckler. But in the moment while his side was uncovered, it was pierced by a mortal dart. He fell, and his head, exalted on a spear, proclaimed to the nations that the Gothic kingdom was no more. But the example of his death served only to animate the companions who had sworn to perish with their leader. They fought till darkness descended on the earth. They reposed on their arms. The combat was renewed with the return of light, and maintained with unabated vigor till the evening of the second day. The repose of a second night, the want of water, and the loss of their bravest champions, determined the surviving Goths to accept the fair capitulation which the prudence of Narses was inclined to propose. They embraced the alternative of residing in Italy as the subjects and soldiers of Justinian, or departing with a portion of their private wealth in search of some independent country. Yet the oath of fidelity or exile was alike rejected by 1,000 Goths, who broke away before the treaty was signed and boldly effected their retreat to the walls of Pavia. The spirit, as well as the situation of Alagern, prompted him to imitate rather than to bewail his brother. A strong and dexterous archer, he transpierced with a single arrow the armor and breast of his antagonist, and his military conduct defended Cumae above a year against the forces of the Romans. Their industry had scooped the Sibyl's cave into a prodigious mine. Combustible materials were introduced to consume the temporary props. The wall and the gate of Cumae sunk into the cavern, but the ruins formed a deep and inaccessible precipice. On the fragment of a rock, Alagern stood alone and unshaken, till he calmly surveyed the hopeless condition of his country, and judged it more honorable to be the friend of Narses than the slave of the Franks. After the death of Tyus, the Roman general separated his troops to reduce the cities of Italy. Lucca sustained a long and vigorous siege, and such was the humanity or the prudence of Narses that the repeated perfidy of the inhabitants could not provoke him to exact the forfeit lives of their hostages. These hostages were dismissed in safety, and their grateful zeal at length subdued the obstinacy of their countrymen. Before Lucca had surrendered, Italy was overwhelmed by a new deluge of barbarians. A feeble youth, the grandson of Clovis, reigned over the Austrasians, or Oriental Franks. The guardians of Theodebald entertained with coldness and reluctance the magnificent promises of the Gothic ambassadors. But the spirit of a martial people outstripped the timid counsels of the court. Two brothers, Lothair and Bucalin, the dukes of the Alamanni, stood forth as the leaders of the Italian war, and 75,000 Germans descended in the autumn from the Rhaetian Alps into the plain of Milan. The vanguard of the Roman army was stationed near the Po,